This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Kitchen Boy by Robert Alexander. Read for you by Alan Lewis Rickman. In Memory of My Mother, Elizabeth Cottrell. Author's Note. While this is a work of fiction, the indented passages, secret notes, and letters attributed to the Romanovs, their captors, and Rasputin are all accurate and can be found in various archives. Taking creative license, I've made changes to only one of the documents, Empress Alexandra's long letter, which appears midway through the book. That letter, written to Anna Virubova, is actually a compilation of two different letters that Alexandra wrote and secretly smuggled out of their captivity. Prologue. St. Petersburg, Russia. Summer 2001. Peering through the peephole of her apartment door, the old woman didn't know what to do. Finally, she cleared her throat and called out in a voice as frail as an October leaf.
Кто там?
Who's there? On the other side of the thick padded door, the young stranger, tall and striking, her hair brown and thick, replied not in Russian but English, saying, A friend from America. Instantly, the babushka's weary eyes blossomed with tears. It could be no one else. It had to be the girl from Chicago. And realizing it was the moment she had both feared and prayed for, the aged Russian beat her chest in a frantic cross. Next, almost without thinking, her hands worked the crude Soviet lock and she heaved back the door. Fully aware of their miraculous collision of fate, the two women stood in quiet awe. The American, her eyes shimmering with tears of relief and grief, broke the awkward silence. Perhaps you don't realize who I am, but in a language she had barely spoken since before the times of Stalin, the woman strained for the English words and in a hushed, careful voice said,
I know who you are, dear Katya. Of course I do. And not just from what they write of you in these newspaper stories, either. Конечно нет.
Of course not.
No. You should not have come, but I prayed with all my heart that you would, which, of course, was so very selfish of me.
She reached out, touching Kate first on the shoulder, then her soft cheek.
Yes. It's really you. And yet how did you even think to come looking for me?
Hiding her pain behind a pathetic smile, the young woman pulled a cassette tape from her black leather purse. My grandfather left this for me.
I see, muttered the babushka with a wise cluck of her tongue.
Now come in, my child, come in quickly. We have much to discuss, and you can't be seen standing out here. 1.
America, summer 1998. My name is Mikhail Semyonov. I live in Lake Forest Village, Illinois State, the United States of America. I am 94 years old. I was born in Russia before the revolution. I was born in Tula Province, and my name then was not Mikhail, or even Misha, as I am known here in America, no. My real name, the one given to me at birth, was Leonid Sednyov, and I was known as Lonka. Please forgive my years of lies, but now I tell you the truth. What I wish to confess is that I was the kitchen boy in the Ipatyev house, where the Tsar and Tsaritsa, Nikolai and Alexandra, were imprisoned. This was in Siberia, and the night they were executed, I was sent away. They sent me away, but I snuck back, and that night, the moonless night of July 16th to 17th, 1918, I saw the Tsar and his family come down the back 23 steps of the Ipatyev house. I saw them go into that cellar room, and I saw them
shot. Trust me, believe me when I say this. I am the last living witness, and I alone know what really happened that awful night. Just as I alone know where the bodies of the two missing children are to be found. You see, I took care of them with my own hands. Misha took a deep breath, tried to push himself on, but couldn't. Panicking, he hit the stop button on his tape recorder and just sat there on the flagstone terrace of his home, his eyes fixed straight ahead on the curling waters of Lake Michigan. Despite his determination, he'd faltered, been unable to proceed. Over the many years since the Russian Revolution, Misha had come to realize that on a single night in 1918, he had witnessed far too much for an entire lifetime, particularly in the tortured silence he had so sternly observed in the ensuing decades. But such was his punishment. He was an old man, certain that this long life and clear memory were the torture he deserved. Yes, there was a God, for if there were not, he would have been spared this suffering. Instead, he kept on living and remembering. True, he had gained some wisdom, for over the course of all this time, he had come to look at that night as the start of everything horrible that had since befallen his poor Asiya. As he looked back from these United States, and through the distance of the decades, it was all so clear. A great curse was unleashed that night, inundating every corner of his vast homeland. If his comrades could commit such an act, was it any wonder that Stalin could kill upward of 20 million of his own people? No, of course not. On a hot night in the Siberian city of Yekaterinburg, the individual had become expendable. Misha was a tall man, who walked with the slightest of limps, but over the last 15 years, of course, he had grown smaller and his gait more halting as his body had settled and lost muscle mass. He'd always been trim, and it was this leanness that had undoubtedly contributed to his longevity and his lack of major illness. His hair, which he had always combed straight back in an elegant manner, had been snow-white for more than 30 years, and while it had receded only slightly, it had definitely thinned. His face was narrow and long, his nose simply narrow, while his upper lip was straight and noticeably, almost oddly, small. Since his 50s, the tone of his skin had gone from robust to ruddy to its present parchment color, skin that now hung loosely from his sharp cheekbones. Always a dapper dresser, he wore lightweight gray wool pants and a yellow cashmere sweater over a pressed and starched blue shirt from Brooks Brothers. Seated in a wrought iron chair on the raised terrace behind his grand 20-room house, he stared out over the bluff and at the lake, himself the very image of old Chicago money. Nothing, however, could have been further from the truth, for when he'd arrived in the United States in 1920, he'd had but a rucksack, one suitcase, and the clothes he was wearing. And while everyone believed that he'd made his millions on the stock market down at the Chicago Board of Trade, that, too, was a lie, albeit one that he had carefully cultivated. Staring out at Lake Michigan, Misha was transfixed by the flashes of light upon the blue water, flashes that sparkled like diamonds. He'd been tormented his entire life because of that night more than 80 years ago. A night which until now he'd never spoken of to anyone except May, his beloved wife. But now he must. Now he had no choice. May was already 2 weeks in the grave, and he was determined to follow her as soon as possible. Before he left this world, however, he had certain obligations, namely, to reveal a kind of truth to their only heir, their lovely granddaughter, Kate. May, who'd also fled Russia after the revolution, fully understood the delicacy of the matter, and even though she'd helped Misha decide just how it might be done, he'd put it off. Now, however, the time had come. He could wait no more. He must give the young woman not simply a way to understand, but a reason to fulfill a pledge he had made so long ago. No, he thought. He had to give her more than a reason. He had to set her on a mission. His mission. Otherwise, he feared she might flounder in confusion, even despair, and perhaps thereby stumble upon... No, thought Misha. He couldn't let that happen. He raised his wrist and checked his thick gold watch, which these days hung so loosely on his thin wrist. It was tea time, and if May were still alive, he would be joining her upstairs. Their maid would bring up a pot of tea. Misha and May would each have exactly 2 cups, a biscuit or two, and May, who had been bedridden for the past 3 years, would reminisce about Russia, as she had done so frequently in her last years, chatting about this and that, but, well, she was gone. All that was over. And now Misha needed to take care of this as soon as possible. Clutching the tape recorder in one of his thin hands, with the other he grabbed the arm of the wrought-iron chair and pulled himself forward. With no small amount of effort, he pushed himself to his feet, and then he simply stood there, swaying like a flag in a gentle breeze. Once he'd gained his balance, he started across the flagstones, one hesitant step at a time. At the house, he pulled open one of the French doors, lifted up his foot, focused all his attention on the effort, then stepped into the grand central hallway, a gallery of sorts that ran from the front to the back of the house. The living room lay immediately to his right, and he carefully made his way into this grand room with its dark beamed ceiling and matching woodwork. At the far end stood the focal point, the large stone fireplace amputated from some French chateau, while a palace-sized oriental carpet in deep reds and blues ran from one end to the other. As he moved slowly through the room, Misha wondered what his granddaughter was going to do with it all, these antiques, the oil paintings, the Tiffany sterling and Steuben crystal bric-a-brac that May and he had collected over the decades. Perhaps she and her husband would keep everything. Perhaps they would sell it all. He didn't much care. These common things didn't matter. However, the numerous Fabergé items, including the little jade bulldog with the diamond eyes that sat on the coffee table, and the cobalt-blue enamel opera glasses of the Tsaritsa's sister perched over there on the piano, were an entirely different matter. He'd left detailed instructions in his will, and he prayed Kate would follow his precise instructions. If only his story would induce her to do just that. On the far side of the living room, Misha moved through an arched opening and into his library that was filled with 2 red leather chairs, a large desk, and a massive built-in walnut bookcase that held his entire collection of books on the Russian royal family. Focused on the task at hand, he went directly to his desk and put down the small black tape recorder, laying it next to a manila folder, his dossier, which contained a variety of historical documents. Sure, 1,000 truths. That was what it was going to take to convince his Katya, daughter of his son, which was precisely why he'd carefully collected copies of letters and diary entries and telegrams from that time. And he would not only read from these, but leave the complete dossier for her to peruse, even scrutinize. Wasting no time, he sat down, opened the top desk drawer, and withdrew a sheet of letterhead. He then took a gold ink pen and wrote, August 27th, 1998. My dearest Katya, this tape and these documents are for you. Perhaps together they will help you understand the complete picture. Please, forgive me. Yours forever with love and devotion, Dedushka Misha. Satisfied, he laid aside the pen and paper, and now he had no choice but to continue, to press on to the end. He reached for the small tape recorder, held the microphone to his dry lips, turned the machine back on, and slid into the past. Yes, so, as I was saying, my sweet one, I know what happened that horrible night the Romanovs were murdered. But the truth of the matter is that the beginning of the end of my Nikolai and Alexandra commenced a few weeks earlier, which is to say, I'll never forget the 20th of June, 1918,
the day we received the first of the secret notes.
2.
It was as warm as only Siberia could be in the summer. Humid, buggy, stifling. You'd never expect such a warmth in Siberia, but the northern sun, which had only set for a few brief hours, was already rising high, and in a couple of hours it would be hot, so very hot, in the Ipatyev house. To make matters worse, all the windows on the main floor had been painted over with lime, and we hadn't been allowed to open a single one, which greatly irritated Tsar Nikolai. In the past few days it had been like an oven, really, all of us crammed in there without any fresh air blowing through, and it smelled so stuffy. That wasn't just from the samovar or from our cooking, either, no. It was the guards who roamed our rooms at will. The guards who perhaps bathed only at Easter and on their birthdays. They were so stinky, I say, kindly, greasy, and filthy. For 2 weeks, the former emperor had been asking, just a single window, just a little fresh air, that was all the former Tsar wanted for his family. But the Bolsheviki have always proved inept at making the simplest of decisions, except, of course, when it comes to purges and murder. I can't imagine what it must have been like for him, for Nikolai Alexandrovich. One day, he commands 1/6 of the world, the next, he isn't even in charge of a single pane of glass. Plus, the Tsar had been suffering from hemorrhoids. He'd been in bed one whole day earlier that week. I'd been told it was hereditary. Sure, my sweet Katya, we know many intimate things of those last weeks. In the dossier, the one I've made for you, I have part of his diary in which Tsar Nikolai himself wrote. Thursday, June 6th. My hemorrhoids gave me terrible pain all day, so I lay down on the bed because it is more comfortable to apply compresses that way. Alex and Alexei spent half an hour in the fresh air, and after they returned, we went out for an hour. Alexandra, his Alex, was more circumspect, less trusting, but not Nikolai. He wrote everything in his diary, including their plans to escape. So, that was the way it was when the first of the four notes came. All of us stuck there in that stuffy house that smelled of unwashed guards and soup that had been reheated too many times. And that was how I became involved. After all, the Tsar of all the Russias, even if there had been a revolution, never opened his own milk bottle. Конечно, нет. Of course not. That was my job, me, Лёнка, the kitchen boy. Sure, and my morning duties also included getting the samovar going and greeting the nuns who brought us additional foodstuffs. For a long while, no sisters had been permitted into the House of Special Purpose, which was how the Bolsheviki had rechristened the Ipatyev House. But then all of a sudden they were bringing us milk and eggs and bread a few times a week. Commandant Avdeev, who was in charge before Yurovsky took over, changed his mind out of the blue. I think he was bribed. I think Rasputin's daughter, who lived in a village not far away, gave him money. The Ipatyev House was fairly new, but constructed in the style of old Muscovy, with an elaborate facade and exaggerated cornices. It sat on the side of a small hill, with the main living quarters on the upper floor facing Ascension Square in the front, and the service rooms in the lower level opening onto the garden in the rear. Built of brick and big stone that was whitewashed, the house was topped with a low, green metal roof. It wasn't like the governor's house in Tobolsk town, where the Romanovs and all of us had first been kept in Siberia. That was more like a summer palace, while this, the Ipatyev house, was more like the home of a well-to-do merchant. Yet even though it was supposed to look like the home of a bayar, an old nobleman,
It was in fact a modern house with indoor plumbing and even electricity, including electric glass chandeliers that came to life with the turn of a switch. This house stood, as a matter of fact, all the way until the 1960s, when a young Boris Yeltsin ordered it demolished because it was becoming a secret shrine for monarchists. And so, early that morning of the 20th, I was going about my duties, not in the main kitchen down below, but in the makeshift kitchen that had recently been set up for our use on the main level. I was as thin as a reed and fairly tall for a 14-year-old, and yet I was still not big enough for my large feet, which caused me no end of awkwardness. My cheeks were large and rosy with youth, and after I had stuffed the center chimney of the brass samovar with charcoal and pine cones and bits of straw, I huffed and puffed on a glimmer of fire. I was just getting it lit, just attaching the vent to the outside, when in walked our sister Antonina and her young novice, both of them dressed in a waterfall of black. A good share of the nun's face was swathed. The black headcloth covered her forehead, went around her eyes, and the folds of her wimple came up just under her mouth so that even her chin was covered. A pink, plump windshield of a face, that was all you could see of our sister, a dumpling of a nun, who was not only a good deal shorter than me, but who seemed so terribly ancient. The novice, on the other hand, was not so severely dressed. She wore a black gown and black headcloth, but her face was not covered. "Good morning, my son," said the nun, coming in with her usual basket. With my right hand I tamed my brown hair. "Good morning to you, Sister Antonina." "I believe you know my charge, Marina." Of course I did, and I bowed my head slightly to the girl. She blossomed the color of a soft rose petal, which in turn caused my cheeks to flush with warmth. She was about my age, the daughter of a local Russian woman and an Englishman who had worked for years at the English consulate there in Yekaterinburg. They said the girl was very well educated, that she spoke both perfect English and perfect Russian, even some French, though she hardly ever said anything to me. Sister Antonina said, "We have brought more fresh goods for..." She glanced out the door and down the hall, spying a guard, a young fellow with a blonde beard, who had been recruited from the local's Lakaza factory, where, not long ago, the workers, infected by the Reds, had revolted and killed their bosses. This young man carried his rifle over his right shoulder, not his left, of course, for that was the rule of the evil Formers, and had a hand grenade hanging from his belt, and Sister Antonina, taking note of him, dared not finish the sentence. Yet, as far as she was concerned, Nikolai Alexandrovich was still her tsar, but she dared not refer to him as Его Величество, his greatness, for she'd be thrown in jail for that. Nor could she bring herself to call him something ridiculous like товарищ or гражданин, comrade or citizen, Romanov. Setting the basket on a small table, Sister Antonina said, "The milk is still warm from the cow. The eggs are just as fresh, too. Marina herself gathered them only an hour ago."
"Спасибо большое, сестра."
"Thank you very much, sister," I replied.
"The butter is very good. You must try some butter on the bread. It's so nice and sweet."
Da. It was then that I noticed that Sister Antonina was still leaning against the edge of the table, her eyes fixed on me, her body not moving a centimeter. I stared back. What? Had I done something wrong? Again, I said, "Спасибо большое, сестра. I'll take care of everything." "The eggs are for the little one," she said, referring to Alexei Nikolaevich, the Tsar's son, who suffered so terribly from what we call the English disease, hemophilia.
"Certainly."
Turning around, Sister Antonina nodded ever so slightly to novice Marina. The girl edged slightly out into the hall, looked one way, the other, then offered a small nod in return.
Sister Antonina, satisfied that the guard with the blonde beard was no longer nearby, reached into her basket and lifted the glass bottle of milk.
Take this, Molodoy Chelovek, young man.
Her eyes were fixed on mine, and I stepped over and took the bottle from her, which contained a chetvert of milk, something like 2 liters, and just like she said, it was still warm from the cow. She whispered,
"Open this bottle at once. God willing, we will be back in a few days."
I was young and clumsy in many ways, but I understood. Since the ancient time of troubles, which preceded Tsar Mikhail, the very first of the many Romanovs, we Russians have used our eyes to say what our mouths cannot speak. And Sister Antonina did this, staring at me, and then blinking both of her eyes. I dared not move. Rather, I just stood there, clutching the warm chetvert, as the sister moved into the hallway, the antechamber that separated the kitchen from the dining room. There, she said a few kindly words to one of the guards, who in turn gruffly escorted her to the front of the house and out. Later on, of course, the Reds killed her for that, for being part of the plan to save the Romanovs. Well, so, once the sestra and novice were gone, I turned my back to the hallway and stared down at the bottle of milk. There was something special about it, of that I had no doubt, but just what, I certainly couldn't tell. I stood there in my worn brown pants and white shirt of coarse cotton, then swirled the milk around in its container. Everything, however, looked, well, normal. I decided to take a whiff of it, perhaps even taste it, so I tugged at the cork stopper, pulled it out, and smelled the rich, creamy milk. And that was when I saw it. Rather, I felt it first. The slip of paper. A tiny pocket had been cut into the side of the cork, and a small piece of paper had been tucked in, which is what I felt, the sharp edge of the paper. Knowing the danger, I glanced over my shoulder and saw no one. There were some noises in the house as the Tsar and his family started to get up from bed, but I was alone there in the kitchen, just me and the samovar, which was starting to rattle as it warmed. I tugged at the paper, pulled it out, and unfolded it. Although I could read and write back then, I couldn't make out a single word, for it wasn't in Russian. Rather, I recognized the letters of the Latin alphabet, but just what language I couldn't tell. French, German, English, they were all the same to me. Only much, much later did I learn that it said, "Les amis ne dorment plus et espèrent que l'heure si longtemps attendue est arrivée." All the notes, even the replies from the Romanovs, were to be in the French. I didn't memorize any of them back then, and of course I thought them lost forever, so I was greatly surprised when, a few years ago, I opened up a book, and there they all were. Every single one of the secret notes, completely reprinted. All this time, all these years, the original note that I had pulled from that cork, as well as the next three, had been carefully stored in the Gosudarstveni Arkhiv Rossiyskiy Federatsii in Moscow. Sure, as incredible as it may seem, these notes are still there, in the State Archive of the Russian Federation, proving beyond a doubt that there had been a plot to save the imperial family. "Da, da, Katya Vnuchka moya, granddaughter of mine." For a brief while, there had been a candle of hope in the note that read, "Friends are no longer sleeping, and hope that the hour so long awaited has come. The revolt of the Czechoslovaks threatens the Bolsheviks ever more seriously. Samara, Chelyabinsk, and all of eastern and western Siberia are in the hands of the Provisional National Government. The army of Slavic friends is 80 kilometers from Yekaterinburg. The soldiers of the Red Army cannot effectively resist. Be attentive to any movement from the outside.
wait, and hope. But at the same time, I beg you be careful, because the Bolsheviks, before being vanquished, represent a real and serious danger for you. Be ready at every hour, day and night. Make a drawing of your three bedrooms, showing the position of the furniture, the beds. Write the hour that you all go to bed. One of you must not sleep between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock on all the following nights. Answer with a few words, but please give all the useful information for your friends from the outside. You must give your answer in writing to the same soldier who transmits this note to you, but do not say a single word. From someone who is ready to die for you, an officer of the Russian army. Ever fearful, I carefully folded up the small note and slipped it in my pocket. This was something important, something dangerous, something for the Tsar, but I just went about my business unloading the basket. I took out the 8 eggs, brown and not so terribly big, and the pale butter, which was in a little billy can covered with a torn piece of oilcloth. And as I waited for the large brass samovar to boil, my face beaded with sweat, my heart raced, and my mind struggled for a course of action. I couldn't just barge into the Tsar's bedroom while he and Alexandra Fyodorovna were getting up. Suddenly, a voice behind me boomed,
"Well, Lonka, so the fire's lit and the water is heating? Очень хорошо."
Very good. It was cook, Kharitonov, all groggy and yawning, his shirt a mess, his oily hair sticking up. He hadn't shaved in almost a week, but then I hadn't had a bath in almost a month. Commandant Avdeyev didn't allow us to make that much hot water, although Nikolai Alexandrovich had been granted a bath of 9 liters just the day before. I thought I should tell him, but I remained quiet, for even then I understood the importance of the note. And so I lied. "Yevgeny Sergeyevich has asked for a glass of water." I was referring to Dr. Botkin, of course. Dr. Yevgeny Sergeyevich Botkin, the Tsar's personal physician, who had voluntarily followed the family into exile and imprisonment. Kharitonov puffed out his lower lip.
"So, do as the good doctor requests, lad, and take him his glass of water."
The drinking water was in a large crock covered with a cloth, and I took a dipper and ladled water into a thin glass with a chipped rim. Saying nothing more, I headed out, clutching the glass in both hands because I was shaking so. As I skirted the dining room, I saw one of the Bolsheviki leading the Tsar's second daughter, Tatyana Nikolaevna, to the water closet on the far side of the house, because that was the way it was. None of the Romanovs could use the facilities without being escorted by an armed guard. Tatyana Nikolaevna, so thin, so pretty, her light brown hair put up, glanced briefly at me, smiled slightly, and hurried on as a guard with a rifle and hand grenade followed immediately after her. She had turned 21 just the previous month. Walking so very carefully lest I spill a drop, I passed from the dining room into the drawing room, where the manservant, Trapp, was putting away his bed things. I proceeded quickly past him to the alcove at the far end, where Dr. Botkin slept on a cot next to a wooden desk. When I walked in, the doctor was standing next to a large potted palm and fastening his suspenders. I was almost too afraid to speak, but in case there were any guards nearby, I forced myself to loudly say, "I brought the water you requested, Yevgeny Sergeyevich." He was a tall man, a big fellow with a goatee, small gold specks, and little eyes, whose granddaughter, by the way, still lives in Virginia. Well, this Dr. Botkin just stared at me, surprised at my impudence. Without hesitation, I went up to the wooden desk and set down the glass of water, managing, of course, to spill a bit in the process. As I frantically mopped aside the water with my hand, I glanced about the drawing room. There were no soldiers, so I jabbed my hand in my pocket, pulled out the small folded piece of paper and dropped it on the desk next to the glass.
"This was hidden in the milk stopper,"
I whispered, my voice trembling. Studying me, he screwed up his eyes and then quickly snatched the note from the desktop. I know he wanted to ask me what in the devil's name I was talking about, but only his eyes dared question. I turned and scurried out just like that and returned to the kitchen, where Cook Kharitonov was preparing the tiny pot of concentrated tea and slicing black bread, yesterday's of course, which was no longer so moist but still nice and sour. Despite my worries, I was exactly right in what I did in how I handled the note. Going that early into Nikolai Alexandrovich's bedchamber might have attracted attention. However, directly approaching Yevgeny Sergeyevich did not. And I trusted the doctor would know exactly how to handle the situation. For he was not only the Tsar's personal physician, not only his close advisor, but, at this point in their captivity, also his dear friend. I didn't know then if Dr. Botkin could read the letters, since it was written in a foreigner's tongue, but he immediately passed it on to the Tsar and his wife. Alexandra Fyodorovna, a woman of tightly strung nerves, never slept well, and hence was always loath to rise in the morning, particularly by 8:15 for the morning inspections. Such were the rules, however. And, in the 20 or 30 minutes that passed between the time I gave Dr. Botkin the note and when the commandant viewed the household, Dr. Botkin must have entered the Tsar's personal room. The Emperor and Empress shared the corner room with their ailing son, the heir, and Dr. Botkin must have gone there under the pretext of checking Alexei, or perhaps the Empress herself, she had a bad heart, not to mention bad legs, and then slipped them the piece of paper. By the time we were gathered for inspection, it was obvious the Romanovs had read the note. Ever since the heir's lackey, Nagorny, had been hauled off to prison, we had been using the Empress's rolling chaise, a large wicker device on wheels, to carry the heir, for Alexei was still recovering from a recent bleeding episode. And as I pushed Alexei into the dining room and around the end of the table, I burned red with embarrassment akin to fear as the Tsar and Tsaritsa stared upon me, Lyonka, the kitchen boy. Had I done wrong? Was I in trouble? Even though Alexei Nikolaevich was ill, even though he had lost so much weight, everyone kept saying he was growing as fast as a mushroom after a spring rain, and it was true. Tsar Nikolai, who took after his diminutive mother, was the exception in the family, for he was no taller than 5 feet 6 or 7 inches. On the other hand, the heir Alexei, had he not been murdered, would have been a real Romanov, tall as a tree and big as a bear. And that summer, the two of us were nearly the same height. He had dark hair, bright, sharp eyes that seemed to drink in everything, and as usual, he wore a white bed shirt, and his legs were covered with a blanket. That day, though, he told me he'd slept poorly. Truly, this handsome lad was as pale as the moon, his skin almost translucent, because hours ago he had been woken by red troops marching past the house.
"The whites are on the way,"
he whispered with excitement as I positioned him next to his mother. So there we all were, gathered in the dining room, the 7 Romanovs, Botkin, Maid Demidova, Cook Kharitonov, Valet Trapp, and me. Lining up behind the heavy oak table, we automatically assumed our positions. First the Tsar, the Tsaritsa, the heir Tsarevich, the 4 daughters from oldest to youngest, and then the 5 of us, from Dr. Botkin down to me, the last. That was the way it always had been at court before the revolution, and still was in this house, everyone perfectly aware of their rank, and automatically assuming their preordained position. And what a handsome family they were. As always, Nikolai wore a khaki field shirt with the epaulettes ripped off, cut away by order of the Bolsheviki, khaki pants of coarse cotton, worn brown leather boots, and of course that cross of St. George on his chest. Sure, he was short, sure his nose was a bit stubby, and his neck not too long, but he was trim, his arms surprisingly strong, his beard so beautiful, his eyes so sweet, his voice deep and rich. And Alexandra? She was quite tall, quite imposing and regal, and that morning she wore little jeweled ornamentation and the same loose, dark blue cotton dress she had been wearing for many days. Though she was by then painfully thin, in her youth she had been a true beauty, her hair light, her complexion pure and white. It was no wonder their girls were so beautiful, their son such a treasure. Waiting for the Bolshevik leader, all of us stood silent, except Anastasia Nikolaevna, the youngest daughter. In her arms she held her little black and tan dog, Jimmy, the tiniest of King Charles' spaniels, and the young Grand Duchess kept saying little bits of nothing into the creature's ears as she rocked him back and forth. Finally, Commandant Avdeev came in, a fat man with a greasy beard and dirty shirt who always went beltless. He suffered from the Russian disease, which perturbed the Tsar because he couldn't abide that, such inveterate drinking, or disorder for that matter. Nikolai Alexandrovich was a tidy man by nature, and he hated Avdeev, particularly since Avdeev had been allowing the other guards to slowly loot the shed where the Romanovs had their trunks stored. The commandant said they needed to examine everything, but in reality, they were pilfering linens and table services and selling these fine goods in the town market. When this was later discovered, Avdeev was rightly sent to the front. As ever, the commandant was a mess, an awful sight. More than likely he'd polished off an entire bottle of vodka the night before, and that morning he must have just gotten up because his hair went every which way, his eyes were all swollen, and even his shirt was unbuttoned. I glanced at the Empress, who was glaring at him with disdain. Anastasia started to giggle, but then her mother gave her the eye. Avdeev, who could barely focus, rubbed his eyes and grumbled, "So, Nikolashka, are all of you here?" All of us flinched. Using that form of Nikolai's name was incredibly rude, especially for the country's number one person. But the Tsar, good soldier that he was, not to mention former commander-in-chief of the world's largest army, calmly replied, "Das, all of us are present." I thought that would be it, that we would be dismissed, but then this slob of a man leaned on the table with both hands, cocked one of his fat eyes, and turned to me and said, "Tell me, Lunka, no one plans to secretly escape, now do they?" Suddenly I had to pee just terribly. It flashed through my mind that they'd caught Sister Antonina and tortured her. Was this a trap? Did they know about the note?
"Speak up, Lunka," commanded Avdeev. "You're young, but I'm sure you have big eyes. You haven't seen anything suspicious going on, have you? Eh? Well, I..."
Everyone in the room from the Tsar on down turned and stared at me, the little kitchen boy with the big feet. I thought the Empress was going to faint right there. The first serious attempt to save them. And she thought I was going to blow it.
"Nyets," I replied, which was short for Nyetsuder, "no, Monsignor," for that was how proper people of that day spoke. He eyed me, studied me for the longest moment. I swear he was going to ask me more questions when all of a sudden Alexei's dog, Joy, a black-and-white English spaniel, came bolting into the room with a squealing animal in its mouth. Demidova, the Empress's maid, tall and chubby, screamed, "Oi!
The dog has a rat!
Boże mój! My God, it's alive! Exclaimed Botkin.
Well, you should have heard the girl's scream. Those grand duchesses had lived an extraordinarily sheltered life. Sure, the entire family had been imprisoned ever since their father's abdication 18 months earlier, but they'd all been more or less imprisoned in the Alexander Palace in Tsarskoye their entire lives. Rarely had they been exposed to the world beyond the golden walls of their nursery, which is to say, I'm sure that no daughter of Yevo Imperatorskaya Velichestva Nikolai II, His Imperial Greatness Nikolai II, Tsar of all the Russias, Poland, Finland, and so on and so forth, had ever seen a big, fat, dirty rat before that moment, and all hell broke loose. No Bolshevik guard could control those white princesses, and they went running and screaming out of there so very fast. That, in turn, scared the dog, who had simply brought to his masters a wonderful trophy, this big fat rat with a long, skinny, pink tail. And when the girls screamed, joy dropped the rat, and Alexei, well, the naslednik, the heir, seeing the rat scamper in terror around the dining room of the House of Special Purpose, suddenly came to life, and he led the charge, sounding like his mightiest ancestor, the terrible Ivan, as he shouted, "After it, Lonka!" He was a rascal, that boy, a real imp. He'd been deathly ill, but he'd also been deathly bored, just lying around in a hot, stuffy house in Siberia, the windows painted over with lime so that he couldn't even look out. What could be worse for a child? And this rat was surely the most exciting thing Alexei had come across in months. Following my orders, I shoved the wheelchaise along, charging around the heavy oak dining room table. Everyone was yelling, the dog was barking, the girls screaming, and this rat. Well, I drove the chaise as if it were the wildest of troikas, dashing this way and that, following each and every order of my young master. Turn to the left, the right, there, over by the sideboard, Lonka. Wait, no, next to the fireplace. Go, charge! The Empress didn't budge. She wasn't terrified of the rat. She just stood there, hands clasped to her cheeks, terrified lest anything happened to her beloved son, that I might crash him, and an entirely new bleeding episode would begin. After a few short moments, we had this big, fat, juicy rat cornered, Alexei and I did. The dog was ready to bolt forward, but Alexei leaned from his vehicle and grabbed Joy by the scruff of its neck, and we all stood staring at the big rat, and it curled back its teeny lips, exposed its little teeth, and snarled back at us. And then, Alexei, naslednik to the House of Romanov and the throne of Imperial Russia, released his dog, screaming, "Get him, Joy!" And what did the rat do? Well, it took off, not toward the Tsar and Tsaritsa, but toward Commandant Avdeev, who stood on the other side of the room. Avdeev, big, old, fat, sleepy, hungover Avdeev yelped like a pig and turned and bolted into the hall, the rat chasing after him, the dog chasing after them both, all the way down those 23 steps and into the courtyard out back. Alexei burst into hysterics. Can you imagine a rat chasing away the Bolshevik pig? It was too perfect. In fact, I had never seen the heir laugh so long, so carelessly. And that, in turn, started a chain reaction. The Empress was only somewhat amused by this scene, but she was overjoyed at seeing her sickly son so vivant. And then the Tsar started laughing, as did Botkin, and the others. We all started, and then we just couldn't stop. "Bravo, Alexei Nikolaevich,"
called Botkin in a hushed voice so that the guards in the hall wouldn't hear. It was the one and only time that I ever saw the Empress just let loose and laugh and laugh. And when she did, she was so beautiful. That pure skin, those radiant blue-gray eyes. Before the war, all the best society and almost everyone at court had grown to disdain Alexandra, calling her haughty and aloof. But that just wasn't so. That wasn't the Empress I knew. Instead, from what I saw back then and from my readings since, I've come to understand not only how nervous Alexandra became in public, but how shy and reticent she was with anyone except her immediate family. In truth, I think she was horribly depressed and insecure, for her soul was damaged, having lost her parents at a young age, and she was ever fearful of losing her son from a bleeding attack, or her husband from an assassin's gun. But, right then, she clasped one hand over her mouth, one around her waist, and she rocked back and forth with such mirth. It's my guess that that was the last true laugh of her life. "Nikki, can you believe it?" she managed to say in Russian, because, of course, those were the commandant's orders that they speak in the language understood by the guards. Almost always the Tsar called her Alex, but right then he said, "Solnishka." "Sunny," he said, using his pet name for his wife. I... But lacking words, he came over and bussed her. He wrapped his strong arms around her and kissed her ever so passionately. And even though there were others present, she spoke her heart, saying, "I love you. Those three words have my life in them. Yes, this I know without a doubt. Never have a king and queen loved each other more than Nikolai and Alexandra." 3. Katya, do you know what is as asinine as communism? Autocracy. One man, one person, cannot rule the hearts and minds of millions. Liberty, freedom, truth. This America can be such a silly place, so fickle and naive, sometimes so childish, but it saves itself because of those first three things. If only Nikolai hadn't so ardently believed in divine rule. If only he'd loosened the reins. If only Alexandra's first child had been a healthy boy. The whole country was waiting for an heir, and when she finally gave birth to a boy, her fifth child, and he turned out to be so sickly, it all but killed her, it truly did. You know, it's really so odd they called her Nemka, the German. True, she was born a minor German princess, but after her young mother's death, Alexandra was raised primarily by her darling granny, as she called her beloved grandmother, Queen Victoria. So she was essentially English. And then, during the Great War, there was so much gossip and slander against the Tsaritsa. The newspapers printed such terrible things. They threw so much gas on the flames of discontent. Why, they wrote that she, the most prudish of all tsaritsas, slept with Rasputin, that mystical monk from Siberia whose hypnotic eyes alone eased the pain of Alexandra's sickly son. Yes, Rasputin was a scoundrel of the first degree. His debauchery ruined the reputation of the imperial family, and no doubt about it, his horrendous advice to the Tsaritsa hastened the revolution. But did she ever have sexual relations with that tall, brutish man with the animalistic stare? Absolutely not. The papers also wrote that Alexandra kept the Tsar perpetually drunk and had a direct telegraph cable line from her mauve boudoir to her relations in Berlin. And the Russian people, both the nobility and the masses, came to believe it all, that not only was she Rasputin's mistress, but that she was a traitor to the war and the fatherland. In fact, nothing could have been further from the truth. Why, after her husband's abdication, they dug up her rooms, searched for that cable, and what did they find? Nothing. Alexandra hated the Prussians, thought her cousin, the Kaiser, a fool, which he was. Her truth is revealed in a letter to her dearest confidant, Anna Virbova. What a nightmare that the Germans are supposed to save everyone and establish order. What could be worse and more degrading than that? God save and help Russia. Actually, it wasn't Alexandra but Lenin himself who dealt secretly with the Kaiser. It was the Germans who secretly smuggled Lenin back into Russia in a sealed train car. It was Lenin who signed away all of Poland and a third of European Russia in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. It was... What's been spilled by buckets cannot be retrieved by droplets. Now, where was I? The rat and the commandant. The gray rat was chasing the red pig, and the black and white dog was... Whoa. What a delicious scene. Well, soon thereafter, Cook Kharitonov, the maid Demidova, and I put out the tea. Kharitonov had made the tea concentrate, which he poured into each cup, then added the hot water from the spout of the samovar itself. Nice hot black chai tea. Again no sugar, again no limon, but the children will love this, said Cook Kharitonov, reaching for a small bowl of fruit preserves. Strawberry jam, what a delight, exclaimed the maid, a woman with a round face and big body who was most devoted to her mistress. Wherever did you get it? Sister Antonina brought a jar a few days ago, and I've been saving it as a surprise. One of the sisters made it from their own fruit. Now go on, you two, on your way. Demidova carried the tray with the teacups, while I followed behind with the small bowl. Once she served the tea, she took the jam from my hands and placed it on the table with great flourish. "What a nice treat we have for you this morning," she said. "Sweet preserves, me first," pleaded Anastasia. Alexandra issued her dictum. "That will be fine, dear, but you must wait until everyone is seated." As we took our places, we were overcome with awkwardness, for the commandant had ordered that we must all sit at one table, master and servant alike. The family and Dr. Botkin were already seated at the large oak table, and one by one we sat, Demidova, Trapp, me, and Cook Kharitonov, who came in bearing eggs for the heir. The Romanovs accepted the brutal affront to rank more quickly than we, the last of the thousands upon thousands of attendants who had formerly waited upon them hand and foot. And even though we'd been doing this for weeks, it didn't feel right. The likes of me sitting right across the table from Nikolai Alexandrovich, even if he was now the former Tsar. Once we were all at the table, we waited for Batushka, the dear father, to make the first move, signaling the start of our meal. When Nikolai Alexandrovich reached for his spoon, however, he found nothing. "Here, Papa," said Olga, the eldest daughter, unable to hide a smile. But that's the way it always was. We were always a spoon, two forks, or a few knives short. Because in addition to banishing silver and linen from the table as too decadent, the commandant had purposely ordered a deficit of cutlery. "Thank you, my dear," said the Tsar to his daughter. "I thought the shortage of utensils very mean, very humiliating. But Nikolai and Alexandra dealt with such rudeness without complaint, they did. Nikolai simply accepted it as his fate, for his saint's day was the day of Job, the long-suffering, while Alexandra found it her duty to follow her husband's example. And those five royal children likewise complied, never